Hello, Voices of Wrestling listener. Dave Ryan here. Have you ever wondered to yourself how many hidden gems are hidden away inside the last years of World Championship Wrestling? Have you ever asked yourself how many tenuous gags can be made about the name Mike Enos? And have you ever thought about what it sounds like for two Irishmen to interpret a very chaotic company through its B-show? The answers to all this and more are just a click away. Check out Days of Thunder every second Thursday on the Voices of Wrestling podcast network.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling podcasting network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Kids, do you like professional wrestling? Well, we like professional wrestling too. This week, in the news, SummerSlam 2025 is official for two nights. The lazy river of wrestling criticism, Jey Uso wins the Intercontinental title, and Invader Club, Mike Awesome versus Masato Tanaka from ECW Heatwave 1998. I am Jeff Hawkins, he is Chris Novembrino, and Chris, it is that time of year again. The most horrible, horrible time of the year for those of us in podcasting who don't care about these things. That's right, it's Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame season, Chris.
Oh, God.
Oh, the podcast where they'll go, you know, Zack Sabre Jr. has a better case than Ole Anderson to get into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame.
This is other stories.
For me,
every year, the exciting question is, will I or will I not get a ballot?
Oh, well, you won't. I won't.
Yeah.
I don't want one. I don't know if you want one. I could ask if you'd like.
No, it would be pointless.
I agree.
I'm more, you know.
I'd like to take them away from people who haven't actually taken a bump. That is my rule. That is what I'd like. Look, if Dave wants to have a Hall of Fame for people who have actually worked in wrestling, cool. And then they can all do it, and they can do it. I just think we've started giving far too many to podcasters and writers and quote-unquote historians and, you know, people with spreadsheets who love to compare their 3.5 to 3.75 star matches and whatnot. I'd like to listen to this podcast, but it's an hour of people comparing their ballots. I don't want to hear it. Just vote and go on with your lives, guys. You're not contributing.
I don't find the analysis to add anything.
No, I don't. Same here.
New. Yeah.
Let's get to something, because you dropped a little truth bomb on me that I wasn't even thinking about. I didn't think you were going to watch any of this, but yes, Mr. McMahon, the documentary, has dropped on Netflix. And before you get into your opinions on episode one, here's the point where I tapped out, Chris. It was consensual. And even if it wasn't consensual, the statute of limitations has run out. That's all you need to know. It's the guy, you know, I didn't kill her, but if I did, you'd never find out about it, coppers.
After that line, right? If you think McMahon didn't do it, then you are the type of person who leaves room for doubt with OJ. That is just narratively where we are at. And I don't feel like that's a false equivalency in any way, shape, or form. McMahon incriminates himself pretty badly on the documentary, despite the fact that for those who are watching for the acute stuff that is going on right now with Janelle Grant, perhaps you were left wanting. I just watched the first episode, and I didn't find myself necessarily having energy to go through the dude's entire career, because I know his career, and I wasn't expecting him to say a ton of new things. The CTE stuff, that, you know, I caught, like, you know, when I was like reading about what happened in 2, 3, 4, and 5. That stuff is interesting, of course. Austin saying I'm not a CTE guy is going to be one of those quotes that haunts him. Yeah, that's going to be a meme that's going to haunt his
when
ass.
He can't remember his, you know, his wife's name when he's 63. that quote's going to come back to haunt him. Yes.
Right. Are you a CTE guy now, Steve? Yeah. Right. I also found myself legitimately baffled during the Benoit segment because McMahon, for his part, does not seem to have a cogent narrative as to what happened, how we got here. I'm not saying he needs to be the detective or whatever, but clearly something involving the work led to what happened behind closed doors. And there's dots that could have been logically connected there. And to this day, it just still sort of feels like he's saying roid rage is the narrative.
This whole project, to me, just from watching the little that I did of it, is one of those projects where I think nobody really knew what they wanted out of it and knew what they're going to get out of it and knew, you know, because McMahon is the guy who basically gave the approval. Yes, do a documentary on my life, but make sure you don't sugarcoat it. And you're always like, when those types of guys do those things, you're just like, yeah, but I don't think you want a hit piece either, do you?
Right in the opening salvo, he says he's going to try not to give you. I'm not going to try to give you too much interest.
Yeah, I'm not going. I'm not going to tell you. If I could tell you the stories, it's like, well, then
semi interesting. Oh, you know what the other quote is that is going to be stuck in my head forever?
Which one
about the three computers in his brain? How there's one computer that is there that's thinking about everything that's going on. There's a second computer that's thinking about sex. And then there's a third one, and he doesn't even want to elaborate what that computer thinks about.
You know, computers can multitask, Vince. No need three of them.
Well, what if you don't want computer one to know what computer three is doing?
And of course, computer two is all full of Trojan viruses and stuff because it's nothing but like hardcore pornography sites with adware and shareware. And
Trojan, inadvertently, a very strong word choice there, Jeffrey.
I just didn't mean it that way, but okay. I was just thinking viruses.
You could have rolled with it and owned the points, but no points awarded. I'm sorry. We'll have to move on.
I wasn't sure which point you were trying to make. So it's early.
No, but that one will really stick with me. I'm trying to think.
Why would you want a documentary if you're not going to tell the truth? That's the thing. It's like,
you know why? You know why? Because he wants to be discovered. He wants to be found out at long last. That there is a part of him that is deeply self-preservationist. And that will always be this Mr. McMahon, I need to fight against even the documentarian team that I welcomed in. But then there's this other part of him that needs to tell on himself. He has this compulsive need to tell on himself. I mean, yeah, we finally got the stuff that implied that there might have been some incest that went on when he was younger. And at minimum, he said dispositively that there was physical abuse. And his way of processing that was, well, that just happens and you get on and you get over with it. It reminds me very much of the King of the Hill scene where Hank is talking to Luann about trauma and feeling sad and just burying your feelings inside. And whenever you have a feeling, you just stick it deep inside and it hurts a little bit and it feels uncomfortable and makes you mildly nauseous. And you just do that again, and it's okay. And clearly that is the lesson that Vince McMahon internalized well before that, deep early in the 70s. Even the other thing that I think is important when we are analyzing McMahon's product going ahead here, the McMahon wrestling that we got, is that this is somebody who is not a childhood wrestling fan. So you, me, as kids, we watched wrestling. As kids, we had fantasies about what wrestlers we'd like to see wrestle one another, what kind of angles we'd like to see happen, all of these sorts of things. Like childhood fantasies. And I mean this in like the most innocent way. Be like Vader versus Bret Hart or whatever it is. Your favorite guy, Rob Van Dam. Wouldn't it be awesome if you could see Rob Van Dam fight Vader in 1998 or something like that? Vince McMahon has no analogous experience to this. By his own admission, he was not even interested in wrestling until he saw that it was his father's business. And I think that makes it really, that's a really important thing to keep in the back of your mind going ahead, thinking about all these different scenes, many of which are actually reportrayed in the documentary here, that these are television scenes of an adult male's fantasy, not someone who has childhood dreams that like we'd all like to articulate as an adult, whether they're musical or artistic or, you know, making movies or whatever. This is someone who only had dreams about what he wanted to see on screen as an adult, and they're coming from that second or third computer in his brain.
You believe him?
Do I believe him that he wasn't into wrestling as a kid?
Yes.
I don't know why he'd lie about that.
Because he's lying about everything else.
Right. It seems weird for him to lie. I mean, I know he lies about a lot of shit, but like, I don't know why he would lie about that one in service of just building up the disappointment of his father.
Because if you're thinking about where
the lie is being deployed, right, doesn't flatter him in the slightest.
It's a better narrative, at least, to say, okay, he hated his father, so he went into his business and took it away from him. I mean, you know, you can process that. Let me ask you another thing about the criticism from this thing, is that it seemed to, this is from online criticism, that it seemed to separate WWF from the culture that Vince created. In a way that the company was kind of let off the hook in this documentary. You find any validity to that?
I think so. I think it's impossible to look at WWF as anything other than an extension of McMahon, especially before they're a publicly traded company.
Yes, like the Ring Boy scandal, all that other stuff. It seemed to me that McMahon was like, look, as long as we're making money, you go get your jollies wherever you can and stuff like that. And if people complain, well, then they're just, you know, they're not real men or whatever kind of a thing.
No,
like the Tony
and
Atlas
I think
thing.
You nailed this. I think that Bill Simmons and everyone in the documentarian team did a fundamental misservice in representing the different eras here. That prior to them being a publicly traded company, this was not a publicly traded company. This was just McMahon's baby. And I think there's a lot of analysis of the late 80s, 90s, mid-90s, late 90s stuff done through the lens of, well, they were a publicly traded company. And that's actually factually inaccurate. And there's a lot of analysis that comes downstream from that.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think a lot of it is also once they turned on the money machine for Hogan, a lot is because that's where a lot of people came in to be fans. And I don't remember that there was a time before that, too, you know, with the Backlunds and the Brunos and stuff like that. That was, you know, that was being cultivated in this whole thing. When Hogan got there, that's when the drugs really started rushing in, you know, in terms of steroids and all those other things, because that's what Vince found his moneymaker. But it's just like, but the culture had already been built up there with Patterson and Terry Garvin and the Ring Boys prior to that, too.
Yeah, and going back to the question of do I think it's a lie that he wasn't into wrestling as a kid, I don't know. The whole Hogan build speaks to this idea that Vince didn't have a bunch of original ideas. His original idea was, I'm going to steal the AWA build of Terry Bollea, lock, stock, and barrel, and just present it back on my TV.
I mean, not in the documentary, but I was watching some old AWA. And I was, you know, and they were using all the trademarks that Everything. WWE stole. And you're just like, my God, they didn't. Because the story is, oh, we found Hogan and he wasn't really being used all that much in the AWA. And then when he came to the WWF, he became this big star. It's like, no.
No, he was white hot.
They took him. They made him a worse wrestler, which is amazing to think about because he was actually pretty decent when you're watching him against like Bockwinkel and stuff like that. And they took
even the Japanese stuff. Watch his Japanese outings in the early 80s. He's not bad.
No, and they take him, and they literally took all the branding. They didn't take just some of the branding. They didn't just take Hulkamania. They took everything and trademarked it and made buku bucks off of it. And AWA is just like, do we get paid? No, shut up. We're taking everybody. We're taking everything. You get nothing. And it was just amazing. An amazing revelation. Anything else on this that you want to
say? No, I don't know. It's hard to leave feeling remotely sympathetic for Vince in any way, shape, or form, given the way this documentary played out. You know who looks horrible too?
Pritchard?
Bruce Pritchard. Yes. Episode 6. I think it's a great moment to see somebody's flying monkey finally get exposed for being a flying monkey. And Pritchard had no choice but to go out there and talk about what a lovely, great man he is. And for it to just end on, do I think he's an asshole? No, I don't think he's an asshole. Next day, you know, the rape allegations come out and the extended court deposition. 2 days later. I think it's beautiful that Bruce Pritchard's going to have to live with that image because
I think he can live with being a scumbag.
He can live with it too. No, I think so too. I think he absolutely can. But to just see, even for one moment, that there's some sort of price to be paid, even if the price is insufficient.
Living a lie your entire life, pretty much.
Yes.
He's right. Still employed, and by the way. That's what
For sure. But when he dies, he will be remembered like as a skis. Like there's not going to be some grand revisionist history on his contributions to wrestling after the fact.
He was Vince's bagman.
Yeah, he was Vince's bagman. Exactly. Yeah. He buried the bodies.
I need to go in there. Do you know this, if they said anything about the Snuka case?
Oh, I actually didn't watch those episodes.
I don't know if they did, but if they did, I'd like to see if they pressed Vince at all on that. I doubt they did.
I doubt it.
That's,
I mean,
that's the thing that I want to know about. If truth ever comes out, did Vince take a briefcase full of money in there? Did you know, how did that all go down? What did
like how did the Snuka situation get cleaned up?
Yeah.
And how much was Vince involved in that cleanup?
Yeah,
I would love to know that.
That's an unanswered question for me. But other news, WWE made the official announcement that the first two-night SummerSlam on August 2nd and 3rd, 2025, will be at MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey. WWE said they are partnering with the New Jersey Sports and Exposition Authority on the two-date show, which would almost surely mean a substantial site fee, get paid, since WWE's biggest events now go to the biggest to the best bidder. MetLife Stadium had hosted previously WrestleMania's 29 and 35. So we're going to open up the two-night of this one in the Northeast in relatively safe territory. Are you ready for the big four to be two nights?
I mean, I don't anticipate myself ever doing one of these two-night shows unless the card is just white hot. It would have to be a white hot build to a SummerSlam.
There's always with these two-night, when the two-night mania started, there's one night that just knocks out of the park and one night where you go, well, that wasn't bad. but it wasn't as good as the other night.
Right. Well, that wasn't bad. And then you think about how much you paid for it, yeah. And it's definitely not.
Oh,
worth
I'm not
it.
Doing them live. I don't think I'm ever going to a live WrestleMania or a live two-night event ever again.
No, I know, right? Like I did that in Dallas, and that was the first two-night WrestleMania ever. And like I'm glad to be able to say that I was a part of that. But that was. Oh,
I mean, even the weekends where I went, when I would go to Mania and I'd go to like Mania, Raw, and SmackDown Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and then you'd go to all the indie shows on Saturday. That was exhausting. And I'd come back here and get on the air. I go, you know what? I really don't like wrestling. I don't want to watch
right.
it anymore.
In a way, it's memorable that I could say I was there when Roman Reigns and Triple H got booed out of the building in one of the duddiest main events to a WrestleMania in recent vintage. But that's not something I would want to pay for. Like, if you told me up front, do you want to be in attendance when a really shitty match goes down? Would you like to pay premium prices for this experience, Chris? I just don't see myself getting there.
No, neither would I.
Not with my money.
A retraction from last week. Turns out that Penta and Phoenix have not signed with WWE because they are still under AEW contract. And all those stories that have been leaked to certain websites and whatnot are false. Also, Tony Khan has decided he's going to add injury time for Rey Fénix up to almost a year. So they can't go just yet. Obviously, Penta is still going when his deal is up, which is within the next 2 months. But officially, the story that has to be said is that he has not negotiated with WWE, but will do so when his AEW deal expires. The word is that WWE made him a competitive offer, so that solidified his decision to leave. There are a lot of reasons, including frustration. He had first heard about it when he...
Not that guy. He's a happy fellow.
Oh, no, he's never a malcontent. When he first heard about it, when he was pulled from shows because CMLL talent was on shows, and he felt that was disrespectful to him, having been there from the start. The funny part is that it was not only rectified when CMLL dropped that stipulation, but Penta and Phoenix even did a show at Arena Mexico. That went so well that there would have been a big business for a Mystico versus Penta main event, but there was no follow-up from their non-finish in the trios match there. But obviously, there were other issues about being unhappy about he was being used. Hint, hint, him. Hint, hint, Conan. As far as Phoenix goes, right now, AEW is tacking on injury time, which is nearly but not quite 1 year. Khan made both significant offers to stay, but they wouldn't sign a new deal. Chris, this is workers' rights, and this is supposed to be the good guy company are all out in force, saying that this is wrong for AEW to do because they want to leave, so they should be able to leave.
Hey, no, you know what? I'm glad because these are normally the same. I'm glad that AEW is being held to account by that metric because that is a metric that they have hidden behind before, that they are the workers' rights company, that they are the one that's better for the workers, all that sort of thing. So you live by your sword, you die by your sword.
Okay. I will. I'm kind of...
This is the country music star who loses their career for infidelity. Normally, I wouldn't necessarily care about that for a rock music musician or another type of musician, but if you build your brand on being like a family man country guy, and then you get busted for cheating, and that has outsized repercussions, well, that's the brand that you were kind of building yourself around.
Here's what I'm going to say, because Penta had been talking about how they were going to WWE this whole time. And Conan's in their ear, blah, 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 blah. If you're going to be talking about the new hot girl you're dating, make sure your car's out of your ex's garage first. That's all I'm saying. I get that there's probably some pettiness on AEW's part here to do this. I also, it's just, maybe it's a personal thing with the Lucha Brothers and how much I've heard about if you're not doing a Lucha Brothers match, that they're kind of difficult to be around. it's one of those things where I'm split because I'm just like, yeah, company should hold you account to the contract that you signed at times. I do. I get that you know, this is show business and other things. And if people are unhappy, they should be able to leave and go where they can be happy, et cetera,
well,
et cetera.
I also think Tony Khan could probably benefit from being able to cut some salary right now. So this seems a little bit like pride.
Well, that's the other thing, is I think this could be negotiated. If you're Rey Fénix, hey, I'll forego the rest of my salary for this contract if you'd like to cut me right now, please.
Yeah, I'll take another angle on this. Tony Khan shouldn't have been offering these guys extensions.
I agree.
That was stupid.
That was dumb.
They're not doing anything with these guys in the company. And now, given the dynamic, they have absolutely no plans on doing anything with them in the company. So having him sit sidelined still means you got to pay him out. And sidelining Penta means you got to pay him out. Just cut these guys. You don't know what to do with them. You have no plans to do anything with them. And if anything, what is happening by sidelining Penta is you're kind of building up his stock a little bit. The fact that you're going so out of your way to sideline these guys and keep them in the cooler makes them more intriguing than I actually think they really are.
Yeah, I was interested in that vignette that they played on Raw, because it was an R, P, and an F in a circle, and I thought that might be like Rey Fénix of Pentagon, but it's not. I think that's a Viking Raider thing that's coming up. I thought, because I was under the impression that they had signed, but it turns out they're all out. I mean, number one, I think their mistake is also just listening to Conan, but that's me. I just don't find him to be a smart businessman.
You shouldn't say things like that.
I shouldn't say something like that?
No, you really shouldn't.
Why?
You just shouldn't say things like that. That's mean.
I thought you had another point to that.
No. I you know what the point is? It's nice to be nice when it's time to be nice, Jeff.
Thanks, Patrick Swayze.
You're welcome.
Chris, how do you feel about the announcements of breakups of relationships? Because I just here's context for you. Ric Flair and a girlfriend of 13 years, Wendy Barlow, I think that's Fifi the maid, have broken up, and Flair writes on Twitter, all with the first letter capitalized, by the way, "Wendy and I enjoyed 13 great years, and it's with every couple we have experienced our up." I can't read this. This is stupid. Look, nobody cares, Rick. Nobody cares if you broke up with your girlfriend. It's not, it, to me, it comes off as I'm announcing I'm single again. It's like, you're 75.
Nothing tells on a relationship more than the phrase "we've had our ups or downs" or "we need to work stuff out." Like, because maybe once or twice in a marriage, something like that happens. But if it's something that happens biannually, like once a year, we can know that y'all are going to be on the rocks. This was never that good of a relationship, dude. It's just a thing you kept going. Let us not mistake quantity for quality.
Well, not only that, but whenever they go, "we are doing that, we are doing it," you know who's not talking in all this? Her. She's not coming out with any statements.
That's always true. In every single breakup, there's always somebody who takes the noble position of adopting "we" as their new pronoun. Like, "I think we need time and space."
Yes.
I think we need
we're
to
growing
think
apart.
About this.
No, you're growing apart. I'm
no,
growing
I think
here.
You need to stop speaking for me. Yeah.
I read that. I went, "Rick,
so, yes, no,
I
also will. I tend to believe that the person who adopts the "we" pronoun is the bad guy. So there
yes,
you go.
Yes, always.
Always.
Always. Speaking of which, I think, in my opinion, not slander, Artem Chigvintsev, which this is a story I had not touched for a few weeks until it had gone there. The current husband of Nikki Garcia, a.k.a. Nikki Bella, will not be prosecuted after his arrest on suspicion of felony domestic violence in a case that got a lot of publicity. Napa County District Attorney Allison Haley said that on September 24th that her office has decided not to pursue criminal charges against Chigvintsev after evaluating all the evidence. Haley said the office didn't believe they would be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed a crime. Yeah. Divorce is still going on. To me, that says Both of them were probably fighting pretty hard there. I got nothing else on this. I don't have a comment on, but it was one of those things where I was like, why didn't you talk about this? I go, because it hadn't resolved yet, and I don't want to trash anybody in case. But if the DA is saying we can't pursue a criminal charge here, I don't know what to believe, so I don't have an opinion.
Okay, I'll give slightly more. I think the evidence is clearly in that this guy is a violent guy.
Yes.
But it also seems like there was perhaps a violent situation.
A reciprocal
giving like,
of violence somehow.
It's always, it's tricky. So there is what is right and there is what is legal. In a situation like this, especially with this guy who sounds like an effing creep, you know, fighting back, maybe giving him a dose of his medicine, maybe one-upping him, totally within your right.
I will add an extra degree of difficulty because in the divorce filings, Nikki Bella said that she would like her husband to have 50% visitation rights.
Wow.
Yeah, that's where I went. Well, either this is a I don't want to ruin his life with a felony conviction type thing, and he's the father of my child, so I don't want to hurt him, or it's a mutual assured destruction type of thing.
Right. No, that's what I'm saying. I mean, she's a former professional wrestler, Jeff. So, like she knows how to use a chair.
Okay.
She knows, right? Like this is not someone who's untrained with using weapons, throwing a drop kick, throwing a punch. Okay, they're all faked. You don't think they throw it on an actual real bag too? So I think that he's a violent dude. I think that you know she didn't just run out of that. And again, this is the difference between right and legal. If she wanted to win this outright legally. You take your licks, go and document all of it, submit it to the courts, and hope that you win on the merits. That's not something you can always trust on, as actually you and I were talking about before the show, given the contours and nuances of the justice system, right? So then we get back to the court of right and wrong, which is, you know, like you deal a blow to me. Now I'm within my boundaries to defend myself and strike back and get my licks in. And I think that's probably what went down.
Professional wrestling star Maxwell Jacob Friedman has joined Adam Sandler in Happy Gilmore 2. Oh, please make him Shooter McGavin's son. Please, please, please make him Shooter McGavin's son. I think he's going to do okay. I'm fine with that. That sounds like good casting to me.
Yeah, I think he's going to do okay. I think the problem is that the movie is going to probably stink.
Oh, the movie's gonna, it's a straight to Netflix type of Adam Sandler deal. So
right, and all of this
it's
Netflix
be a member berries type of
no, this Netflix, it's more like a Where Are They Now berries sort of approach to like Ellen DeGeneres and Adam Carolla and Joe Rogan and all these people where we kind of like dust them off one last time where it's like this is where they're at now.
Chris,
I don't even remember. Yeah, Chris Rock, Dave Chappelle.
Chappelle, in a way.
Yeah, that's when Netflix kind of started that whole arc of getting talent like this and making content like this. And it's member berries for some people, and I think it's more gawker berries for others.
Comings, goings, signings, etc. The Outrunners, Turbo Floyd, and Truth Magnum have signed with AEW. Hikaleo appearing on the internal NXT roster. I don't know if I said that last week, but I might have. Dustin Rhodes expected to re-sign with AEW. Nothing either way on Daniel Garcia right now. Malakai Black's contract expected to expire soon, and he's expected to go back to WWE to be with his wife. And Saraya expected to have her option year picked up by AEW. Any thoughts on any of those, Chris?
These... pretty much with the only exception off the top of my head of Garcia should be cuts. This is not a company that needs to be adding on talent. They need to be finding space and utility and maximizing the value of the contracts they already have on the books. Garcia is worth keeping. Everyone else, I would pretty much let walk. The Outrunners are fun if you're not overpaying for them. Perfectly fine addition, but I wouldn't overpay for them because it's not like WWE is looking to snatch them up.
Yeah, Dustin Rhodes, I think that's more of a thank you because of the Nightmare Factory and keeping that as kind of a place where younger guys from AEW can train and things like that. But he's doing okay on Ring of Honor, but yeah, I
think everyone's ready for Dustin to come back to WWE for one last run, especially with how white hot Cody Rhodes.
I think that's probably why he's expected to re-sign with AEW. I think they're going to overpay him to stay with AEW.
I think that that's the whole point, is they're just overpaying on
the
Dustin.
Saraya one shocks me because I don't think she has any value in AEW any longer. I don't get it. I think this is also so you don't go back for one last run
right.
of WWE.
Right. There are what's the word I'm looking for? These are signings that are not actually of utility to the company. They're just simply designed to hurt WWE. And they seem spite signings, you might say, but they also seem like trauma signings in the way that they let Cody Rhodes walk and they let Phil Brooks walk, and both of those guys have brought massive amounts of value to the company. And I think, reading in between the lines here a little bit too, the big dollar signings of 23 and 24 have not necessarily lived up to their market value. Are we enjoying Okada on TV? Sure. Has he moved the needle at all? Are we enjoying Ospreay on TV? Sure, absolutely. Is he moving the needle at all in terms of ratings? Have we enjoyed Mercedes Moné on TV? Oh, yes. Not so fast about that. is she moving the needle? I don't know about that.
Well, that'll give us a good segue into the lazy river of wrestling criticism, because yet another signing appeared on AEW this Wednesday, that of one, the former Montel Vontavious Porter, now just going by MVP, I believe, for trademark reasons. I look, as a wrestler, I was a huge MVP fan. I thought his entrance with the tunnel and stuff, one of the best things in professional wrestling history. I love him as a spokesperson. I don't know if I love him in AEW, and I don't know if, because I was thinking about this, because this also is a bellwether that around Wrestle Dream that I believe Bobby Lashley will be starting with that. And for me, I like Bobby Lashley. I don't think Bobby Lashley is a fit with AEW. I think the sickos are going to turn on him. I'm trying to imagine him selling for Swerve. And that just looks kind of ridiculous, to be honest with you.
No, but nobody sells in this company. You don't have to worry about that.
I just... Well, you are technically correct, Chris. I think he's going to be expected to sell.
That's not a limitation.
I liked the Bucks versus...
That was a really good match.
Versus Ospreay and Fletcher, but at the same time,
more times than I can count in my head. It's like Three Stooges trying to get through a doorway of memories.
Ospreay selling the Canadian Destroyer, just doing the hidden blade right off there. I just went, yeah, you're right, Chris. Nobody's selling in this country. But yeah, but also just, I mean, he dwarfs all their big guys too, Lashley does. Like Lashley, you put Lashley next to Hobbs, and Hobbs is going to look like Taz compared to him and stuff like that. So it's just like you're getting one of these big WWE-type giants, and the only guys he could probably be in that ring with and not look like Satnam Singh in some ways is probably Moxley, who's legit 6'4", 6'5", I think, and Okada and those types, and maybe Takeshita. And, you know, I wouldn't mind those matches, but it's not something that the work rate guys are fantasizing about, a Bobby Lashley versus Okada match necessarily. So I just don't know if it fits in this company, Chris.
Yeah, I don't necessarily see a great place. I love the Hurt Business, but the way the AEW ecosystem is right now, with sort of no completed storylines or just a bunch of dangling half-finished storylines, one of the prices that you pay for not wrapping up some of these things, for example, the Bucks hostile takeover of AEW and the power struggle with Tony Khan. I bite my nails every week as I watch this episode, waiting to see what new thing will develop between the Bucks and their half-assed attempts at being Vincent Kennedy McMahon and Tony Khan, Willy Wonka of professional wrestling backstage, Wizard of Oz and Willy Wonka together. We don't see him, but we love him. Not having that completed, having this bizarre Blackpool Combat Club, Bryan Danielson, your way has failed, so I'm going to get Darby Allin to look incredibly stupid and win his number one contendership from him.
Yes.
Having that as a storyline, Swerve is still in the sauce with Adam Page. Like, where does the Hurt Business slot in here? This to me has always been a main event act. So the only thing that the Hurt Business, like the place for the Hurt Business to be, would be they come in and they actually trash the Bucks and Okada in the first week. Basically they established themselves as the new top dogs of this company. Having MVP show up in mid-card hell against Swerve Strickland, who's not leaving mid-card hell anytime soon, I don't think is a great way to launch this faction. My final thought on this is that Prince Nana really needed to deliver a true, heartfelt, connecting promo. And instead, what we got was some of the laziest, tropiest appeals to the past that I've heard. Like, Jeff, you and I have known each other a long time.
Buy my
coffee. Which is just factually accurate, but speaks to nothing about depth or intensity.
Yes.
Or anything else. So saying, like, you know, Tony Schiavone, you and I have known each other a long time. Oh, like what? You know, he was at your daughter's baptism? Like, what are we talking about?
It's also a bad improv trope, because, like, you'll start these things, how long have we known each other? And you just kind of go, well, why don't you tell me so we can establish this relationship right now, you absolute dope. No, and Nana's there pushing his overpriced coffee, which it is, if you've ever been on that website and stuff like, yeah, but you brought in something else, and maybe I'll start more on the Lacey River. Yes, we had the Young Bucks takeover, and then we had now the Moxley takeover of the Young Bucks takeover.
Because Danielson's way failed.
Yes, because Danielson's way has failed. And now, see, I, on Wednesday, on my other show, rebelled against this thinking that you beat Darby here. I think you have Danielson put over Darby and have Darby be the guy who gets rid of Danielson and retires him as a way to pass the torch. But instead, I think they've overthought this, Chris. I think they think, okay, Moxley's going to go in and be the Danielson conqueror, and then we'll put some babyface shine on Darby, probably saving Danielson.
Oh, you forgot
Danielson.
About Christian.
Yes, well, yeah, and Christian.
Christian also in the mix here. So, like, where does MVP come in this ecosystem?
You know what's going to be? It's going to be Darby beats Mox. Christian comes down and beats Darby.
Beats Darby, yep, yep.
Oh, God.
That's exactly, yeah.
Oh, this company is going to screw
Christian's
itself.
Christian's winning this title.
Because Tony loves Christian.
Right.
And he deserves at least a short run. And Darby's going to be the Tommy Dreamer of ECW fame, although he's going to have like a moment with the belt probably or something. I don't know. I'm just like, are we going to come out when the new TV deal comes out and say, hey, we are the next generation of wrestling. We have this top star who is the next guy who people, you know, and look, Darby's an unconventional champion. You can say that, but he kind of...
Oh, he works as an underdog champion.
But he works as an underdog champion.
Yeah,
right?
That's a convention. You know, so they say he's an unconventional champion. People attach to him. He has that, like, Sami Zayn-like quality.
Okay, good.
Daniel Bryan-like quality of, I just effing love this guy. I don't quite know what it is.
He throws his
Johnny
body
Gargano
like
kind of had that too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. In NXT, he had that. He doesn't have it anymore. But
not anymore. But you know what I mean? Like, so that is very much convention. And someone like that, you absolutely can put the belt on. Is there more money in the chase? Yes. But a guy like that, an undersized babyface, who like we feel his pain and we feel his struggle and we love him. That's something that's always going to work, I think.
Yeah, because I don't see the point of going from Danielson to Mox to Darby to probably Christian. Instead, when you could just go from Danielson to Darby, I don't see that. But speaking of which, Chris, because again, I'm sorry to dominate the lazy river, but you're giving me such great segues. Jimmy Uso is Intercontinental Champion.
I'm sorry, Jey Uso is
Jey
Intercontinental
Uso,
Champion. Jimmy Uso betrayed his brother
yes,
like
you're
a
right.
scurrilous dog.
I'm sorry. The money was in the chase there. I don't know if this is...
Oh, God, no. The chase is over. Jey Uso couldn't keep coming up short for singles
titles. No, I get
titles.
That, and I get you had to belt him, but I'm also going, now what? Because he's not going to be the guy that you elevate to that next world title type of stage as an Intercontinental Champion, right? I mean, Braun's getting this title back fairly quickly in terms of Bron Breakker being a short-term champ who's going to probably get the belt back, right?
I don't know. I don't think Breakker's getting this belt back anytime soon. I think Breakker's going to be going on to bigger and better things here.
Okay, cool. Take us wherever you want to go.
Okay. Let's see here on Raw. We have... I am so dumb. Sheamus has never been as boring in the last 5 years as he is with this Pete Dunne shit. Like it is just drab. It is boring. Butch was a bad gimmick, and it's a bad pejorative nickname as well.
It's a bad chant too.
It sucks. Oh, call him Butch. Jeez, it feels so lame. It is trying to make fetch happen only with like two different letters.
Yeah, I did not enjoy that part of Raw at all, to say the least.
It's very, very tedious. I think the Codyverse is a fun place where the baby faces are not irrationally fighting with one another, but they have legitimate points of friction.
Yes.
And disagreement that is all rationally informed. And I think that's the hallmark of Cody's style of writing and Cody's sort of vision for characterization. And I think it works really well. I mean,
yeah,
it
Friday,
makes
like
for a more likable Orton, and it makes for a more likable Owens and a more likable Rhodes.
Yeah. And Owens is definitely playing up the, okay, you picked Roman as a tag team partner. I still don't like him type of a thing on SmackDown last night. I thought that was really good. Now I'm getting a little done with the blood, with all bloodline matches, you know, ending in the beatdown, but I probably shouldn't, because that's how horseman matches always ended. So, I mean, this is kind of that.
The thing is that the bloodline, this iteration, bloodline 2.0 is kind of more bloodline 0.5. It's just not as interesting. The beatdowns would be infinitely more interesting if it was Roman, the Usos, and Solo doing the beatdowns versus Solo and three other guys.
I'm going to give a quick little piece of love to somebody we've talked about over the past few weeks in passing as well. And I thought, again, in a very short role, did very well. I love this Karrion Kross character.
Yeah.
Coming in there and kind of being Sean O'Hare. You know what they're saying in the back about you, Miz. You know, that kind of thing. And he just smiles as Miz takes off and things like that. I think that's going to be interesting to see. I think the Xavier Woods, whatever they decide to do with him, is going to be I hope is going to be interesting. I don't trust Xavier Woods' creative instincts all the time.
I don't either. I don't. I'm beginning to have doubts that this guy understands how to make a heel. I think he gets how to do a wacky, zany babyface team, but I think he's always had a bit of a struggle with characterization for the individuals. The New Day as individuals have never had particularly strong personalities. They have one shared personality between the three of them.
Yes, and this requires
an individual.
Yes, in this iteration, yeah. And especially when they were like the three-man Bootios, trombone, that, you know, all the stuff Kofi was bringing up. But the time they really shined as heels was before they did the... I don't know if you remember the original introduction of the New Day when they were like almost like black separatists in suits and stuff who were like,
yes,
demanding respect and all these other things. And then eventually they got reintroduced in that church choir vignette where that just looks, we all just went, this is the most derivative thing that Vince, this is racist, Vince. What are you doing with this?
And the crowd, my brother, rejected
it's
it.
A New Day. And you're just like, oh my God, Vince, this is racist. What are you doing? But they were also kind of doing the same thing the Usos did, where it's like, yes, you saw these Samoans come out in their tribal gear, but, and then 2 weeks later, they're doing the haka in front of people. And you're just like, yep, so much for that. But I also know that like Woods's creative instincts go towards like anime and stuff like that. I'm just like, oh, it's
right.
Kenny Omega stuff, you know, that's going to happen to him. And I'm watching this and going, he could be interesting as a heel. It could be interesting depending on who he joins up with, or it could be just absolute cringe. So, I mean,
right. In theory, Woods putting together a faction of monster big guys like Bronson Reed and I don't know, a couple others, like maybe Bronson Reed's his point man, and he has a couple of other, like a big tag team or something behind that, and he has his three massive dudes, and he's like, yeah, you know, like a Dr. Doom sort of character,
like taking over Ellering in the First Testament or something,
right?
Like
that. Right, yeah, I know, in a way it's like sort of like if he was essentially taking over Karrion Kross's role, where he took the Authors of Pain and had them with Bronson Reed, right? And this is Xavier Woods's crew of people that he has like a mental thrall over, who are just like these three destructive monsters. And they run roughshod over an entire episode of Raw, where like the entire night, it's the Authors of Pain and Bronson Reed just annihilating people, which would be awesome too, right? Like the Authors just doing the Collider powerbomb and Bronson Reed jumping off the top, and he does like six or seven tsunamis. And we have like a tally at the end of the night of like 10 powerbombs and like 8 tsunamis.
Like Tessitore is chased off for the night, but Wade Barrett sticks around to do commentary or whatever. And it's just every time they try and start a match, the three of them just destroy it or whatever, to the point where nobody wants to come out for a match or something. Yeah, that would be interesting television.
Actually, it'd be great. Tessitore starts off the show, and after the second time, he's like, you know what? I'm not doing this.
I don't feel safe. I'm out of here.
Stu, I'm done. I'm done. And he walks to the backstage, and like he leaves Wade on commentary for the last 2 hours.
Yeah, I'd be here for that.
I mean, so there's a way to get there, but I have my doubts. All right, next. All right, I feel like that more or less covers everything with Raw.
Yes.
Yeah, right. And then we have, all right, what do we get on NXT this week? Julia. I don't think they're doing a great job presenting her. I'm excited for the match, but this isn't a character.
Yeah, she's a presence.
Right.
And I don't know if... I always find her walking out kind of like hunched over or slouched over, kind of... It almost feels like nihilistic in a way, in terms of quote-unquote a character choice. You know, it's like, yes, I'm here, kind of a thing, whatever. Kind of, and I think it's the language barrier thing because, you know, if it were Italian, if this show were in Italian or Japanese, she'd be fine.
Oh God, making her do the "I found my home in the USA" stuff and awkwardly have to take
With
the USA,
Funaki, yeah.
yeah, the USA chant. I was just like, this, who came up with that? Why did they think that was gonna? What did they think that visual was going to look like in their heads? And can I talk to them about what it actually looked like?
I'm gonna go to AEW for my next one. I enjoyed the Nigel Danielson match. I didn't love it, but I enjoyed it. And the one thing that I thought was very, very clever is that Nigel McGuinness never worked to the style to get the sympathy, "You still got it" chant. He was always a heel and always in that heel mode type of a thing. He didn't ever try and get like those baby face moments like, "Hey, remember me?" But also my co-host on Wednesday goes, "Well, that's probably because none of the crowd remember any of his moves either or any of his setups."
I mean, I think a little calm A, a little calm
Little
B.
calm A, little calm B, I think it.
So here, now that we're talking about Grand Slam, here's sort of my problem with AEW in a like writ large, but in a single show. We have Bryan Danielson. He is your world champion. But beyond that, Bryan Danielson is on his final run as an active wrestler right now. I'm a full-time active wrestler on the roster, a semi-retirement, if you will, with an active stipulation on all of his matches that if he loses the title, baby, we done. He is no longer a full-time active wrestler.
Right.
Once you attach that stipulation to Bryan Danielson's matches, they are all by default retirement matches. And Tony Khan and other people booking this show forgot that, and they need to stop forgetting that. Because if Danielson's matches aren't happening anywhere other than at the end of the card, what are you really going to do? You're going to retire Bryan Danielson in the opener of a show? So then it's a foregone conclusion
It's a good
who's
point.
winning this match.
No,
It's
that's a very, very good point. It's, and he
it,
doesn't cut promos like saying goodbye to any of
right.
these towns he's going to either. It's like he's in New
Nope.
York City possibly for the last time. And
I'm
he's
gonna
like,
fight so that I could come back here one more time.
yes, something like that.
Live in the space that you create.
Yes.
Narratively,
And
this is a story you're telling. When he's done, we don't got him anymore. It's over then.
you are the world champion. You are supposed to be a draw, and you're supposed to be drawing people in, and this is your
And
last
Nigel
run.
should be living in the thrall of taking him away from us.
Yes.
He should be feasting on this. The entire build to this match was anticlimactic. The match in a vacuum, and this is my critique. In a vacuum, yeah, if you just watch the match, you knew
Yes.
nothing about any of the stories, what's going on. It's going, hey, it's Nigel McGuinness, it's Bryan Danielson. They had a pretty good match for two guys in their 40s. Can't complain about that. I want something more.
Okay. Go ahead. Do it.
That's I want to be able to give a shit about Bryan Danielson's retirement. I want to hate the fact that Nigel McGuinness came back just to take something away from us.
Yes.
I want to hate this guy because,
Preach.
I could be thrilled that he's back, but he's instead come back to take something from me.
Yes.
So I want to watch this guy fail. I want to boo the hell out of him.
He's been on commentary on Collision this whole time, and we were happy to have him back. Oh, look, Nigel's escaped NXT UK, but no, instead, he's been sitting there biding his time the whole time to come back and screw us out of our goodwill by taking our champion away from us. Yeah, it's
And I want him like living in that I got you. You all thought you liked me, but it was all a ruse. He
Yes.
takes off the mask and he's bathing in it. He hates you. He hates all of you. He hates the fact that you all love Bryan Danielson and that none of you respect him. He hates the fact that none of you can remember his moves. that he's just his afterthought. And this was a guy who was at one point in his career as good, if not better, than Bryan Danielson, especially at that point in time.
Yes, they're making a choice, but they're not diving into it and supporting
the
choice.
Live in the space.
Yes, you've created this world. Now go live by the rules by which you've created. Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. That was a hell of a point right there. I only have one other thing, that's NXT, and that was just the, once again, Javon Evans getting beat. It's almost like they're doing this to say, you know what, all you people saying we shouldn't be beating him, we're going to prove you wrong. We're going to beat him every week, and then we're going to make him a big, big star. But I do like that they continue to tease the Frazier Axiom breakup, and then every time it's the other team that breaks up.
Yes.
It's going to be so awesome when A-Town Down Under, although A-Town Down Under feel like an NXT tag team. I'm sorry to say that. On the main roster, they feel like nothing. But on NXT, they feel like they belong here. So I don't know. Maybe keep them down here again because they're not doing anything with them up there necessarily.
The problem is that Austin Theory continues to be characterization dead weight.
Yes.
This really is. I mean, I get that that's part of the story, that this is the Grayson Waller show. But that's a meta story. Grayson Waller is the personality in this. In Theory, after years now of getting a lot of positive associations, minus that one McMahon one, getting a lot of attention at minimum, still has not found a character that really does anything, means anything, and a personality inside the ring.
Yeah. I have no other stuff for the current wrestling this week. Do you? Did you want to say anything about the Bucks and Fletcher and Ospreay?
Yeah, that was a fun match.
It was fun until the screwdriver. And then it just pissed me off because I'm just like, you've already set the stage for the turn. The moment that the seeds were planted for the turn was Fletcher going, I'm so tired of getting all the way up there and then losing the big one. So the trigger is when he loses the big one, he's going to go heel. You didn't need the screwdriver thing necessarily.
Right. I think it's they wrote themselves in the corner, but I think Will Ospreay choking in this match and Fletcher watching Ospreay drop the ball and hating him for it, that this guy has been rolling, because it's a very human story, right? This is a top-level athlete, but Jordan didn't go out there and drop 30 every single game. He had dud games too. But and this would be a dud game where...
And Fletcher's Pippen here. Fletcher wants to be thought of that way, and it's like everybody goes, well, you're just Will Ospreay's friend.
Right, and like the easy way to get here is Fletcher comes out, he's Pippen, and he plays the game of his effing life.
Yes.
And he's got the Bucks on the run. And then when it comes time to tag in Jordan, Jordan comes in the ring. Ospreay gets super kicked in the face and never recovers. The Bucks keep getting one up on him over and over and over again. And Fletcher's watching this and hurting and going mad inside from the notion that this, he's supposed to be the effing ringer. What? I could win this. This could be me.
He's starting to get nervous that they're going to lose this and that it's not going to be his fault that they lose this. It's like, right. Oh my God, I brought him in there to get me over the top and he can't get me over the top. He starts to internalize it and you can just see him just going, it can start a little bit frantic at first and then you can oversell. I mean, look, we don't need subtlety in wrestling necessarily.
By the end of the match, there needs to be just pure disdain. When Ospreay takes the BTE trigger, Fletcher's watching, he gets knocked off the ropes, and like he could have made it back into the ring, but he doesn't even half-ass it to try to get back into the ring, to try to even break up the count. He just watches Ospreay get pinned, gets back in the ring, and the disdain is all over his face because he just watched Ospreay inexplicably choke. And you have commentary. Sell this. Like, even Don Callis, like, what the hell is happening? Will Ospreay is a premier talent. This is the golden goose. They're killing the golden goose. And Fletcher's just standing there watching the whole thing.
I wouldn't do that, maybe. I would have him.
Well, you can have Excalibur talk about how this Ospreay just can't seem to get on track.
Well, I just meant the Fletcher part, because I think Fletcher giving up like that, I think the psychic break has to happen when the three count happens. I think he has to have hope until just the moment where you see that three come down and go, I can't believe we have, this is the greatest wrestler in the world. And I was teaming with him, and I was doing great.
Absolute shock. No, okay,
and,
I'm with
just
you.
The psychic break of him having the optimism right up until the moment where that three count comes down. And you go, what happened?
Right?
Wasn't my fault. I did my job, kind of a thing. And just then it starts to build right after the match. And you can just see him processing it. And it's all over his face that he's processing what just happened, that he's not going to get the big one again. And then he just slugs Will or something like
that. Right. Well, because that match also would effectively get over that Kyle Fletcher is right about on the he is, yes, the Luigi de Ospreay's Mario, because like if in this case, if Ospreay had lived up to his end of the bargain, they'd be tag team champions right now. So this would have done a lot to build up Fletcher, way more so than the stupid screwdriver spot.
Yes, I hate that.
There's a way to do this. You can do more with less.
And then they get hit with the belts. It's such a WWE finish to me, and
I hated that. Oh God. The belt stuff. The screwdriver stuff was bad enough. But then follow that up with the belt stuff. And then Fletcher gets up and still has fighting spirit.
Yes, he gets his roar spot.
Oh, my God. Like, how many extra hats on top of the hat do we need to have here?
Well, sir, you have chosen Masato Tanaka and Mike Awesome from ECW Heatwave 1998. The floor is yours, sir, for Vader Club.
Oh, boy. So this week, I fired up the Virtual Pro Wrestling 2 cartridge, and while we were playing some rounds of VPW 2, Mike Awesome showed up, and the name evoked a little bit of laughter from my friend, because, I mean, like, if you think about the name in a vacuum, like, a professional wrestler named Mike Awesome is actually a very funny name. Like, it's a deliciously stupid name.
Please tell me after the laughter died down, you go, oh, would you like to see Mike Awesome?
Right. And that's where this came from. I was like, well, Mike Awesome was actually lit.
Yes.
Allow me to show you what this guy was capable of. And we popped on Masato Tanaka versus Mike Awesome at Heatwave 1998. And there is a stretch. For those of you, it's not that long of a match. You know, that's one of the things we try to do at Vader Club is keep them around 10 to 15. We're not trying to do like 45-minute, you know, Okada versus Tanahashi-style matches, unless it's really called for. There's a stretch here between the 8-minute mark and the 12-minute mark where so many unbelievable life-shortening things occur. I am going to recap them off the top of my head.
Please.
First, Mike Awesome proceeds to set up Masato Tanaka on the other side of the guardrails. He then jumps from the ring onto the third rope and springboards from the third rope into the audience. Yes, the guardrails are closer than we keep them now these days. It does not change the sheer awe of this man at that size being able to do that. It's insane. Mike Awesome then gets Masato Tanaka back into the ring, and he grabs a steel chair. Okay, this is ECW. We're kind of used to that. We then get treated to multiple sickening head chair shots,
yes,
that absolutely dent this steel chair.
Steve Austin doesn't believe in CTE.
Oh, I'll tell you what. Masato Tanaka and Mike Awesome don't remember what CTE is, but if they could, they would believe in it. The thoughts don't stay there so much anymore. And then Mike Awesome treats us to an amazing, in terms of verticality, top rope splash. Is it the cleanest splash you've ever seen? No, but again, his height, just unbelievable. And then we go to the outside, and they want tables. It's ECW 1998, and we're about to get tables. Tables on unprotected concrete. And Mike Awesome sets up this table. He then goes back inside the ring, and Masato Tanaka and Mike Awesome proceed to scrum that much more inside the ring. You think that the Awesome Bomb is coming for Masato Tanaka to the outside. He did an Awesome Bomb earlier, and that registered absolutely nothing to the ECW fans. They knew this match wasn't over, even though it was a finishing move. Thank you, ECW, for normalizing that. Anyways, Masato Tanaka proceeds to tuck Mike Awesome between his legs, pick up Mike Awesome for an Awesome Bomb, and then delivers one of the most absolutely sickening power bombs to the outside of the ring I have ever seen in my life. I was actually trying to explain to my girlfriend the purpose of tables in professional wrestling later on in the week. Like, we were just like talking, and
did you come up with? Because I'm
I showed this Mike Awesome spot to her, and she was just like, Jesus effing. Anyways, and
so what was your hypothesis on the table for that spot, Chris?
That Mike Awesome's not dead moments after, because he hits the table, and that at least stops the straight downward trajectory onto the concrete. The purpose of the tables is to increase the force of impact time, which this table does, and Mike Awesome still takes one of the most sickening bumps you've ever seen in your life. You can watch Deathmatch Wrestling. I'm sure that's on par with it. But the camera coverage on this absolutely disgusting bump is quite excellent, and they don't pull away. So you get to live in that moment for a period of time. We then get back into the ring for the finish here, where Masato Tanaka, I'm not going to go blow by blow here. Masato Tanaka finishes off with an excellent looking roaring elbow. But I can't believe that Mike Awesome is not completely concussed by the end of this match after that table spot.
Yeah, and then they decided to recreate this for ECW One Night Only, I think the second one. And that's my remembrance of that was they did the table spot again, but this time Masato Tanaka went through the table. And then Mike Awesome did a splash from inside the ring to outside the ring on top of Masato Tanaka on top of the broken table. And I remember that that's the thing that really got... Because this was also the ECW One Night Only where Eric Bischoff and the Raw guys and I think Coachman and the SmackDown guys were there. And you had JBL being the most JBL jerk you could ever be during that time. And who are these guys? And these guys can't work. And this was the match of the night that popped all of the jaundiced WWE style is better type. Like JBL was like giving them standing ovations after this thing. If you get Tanaka and Awesome together, I mean, Mike Awesome should have been a WWE superstar.
He's Psycho Sid with talent.
He's basically Drew McIntyre before Drew McIntyre existed. Mm-hmm.
He's Drew McIntyre before Drew McIntyre, but like Drew McIntyre was Sid's presence.
Yes.
Like, he has the look.
Yes.
You know what I mean? You could absolutely have given Mike Awesome the Psycho Mike gimmick and have him come out. And if he just seemed like he was nuts, who's the man, fist bumping people, and then delivering that type of match, that is a main event angle. He is having matches with Undertaker, The Rock, Steve Austin, all of these people.
And instead, he gets stuck in Vince Russo's WCW, where he becomes the fat chick.
Disco Mike. Yeah.
Jesus.
Disco Mike. They turn him into a disco guy.
That is a sliding doors moment where you go, what if he had been able to go to WWE instead of WCW?
And what if Vince had seen him and just, like, the light bulb went on, I could make him just an ass load of money with this guy. Because they could have. Mike Awesome, between 1997 in 2001. I mean, WCW tries to roll out Goldberg, and they could put Mike Awesome on the same type of streak, and they'd be like, Mike Awesome, he's like Goldberg, except the matches are good.
He could have been the next Goldberg. He could have. Right. He could have been.
But the matches are good.
Goldberg by then had gotten such an ego and was such a money thing, and like it, towards the end there. Dude, you bring in Mike Awesome to say, I'm the next Goldberg, beats Goldberg, and then goes on a streak of his own. I don't say WCW unscrews itself from what it was going to become, because you could never do that with that number of egos or whatever. But you could have had a guy in Mike Awesome in WCW. You could have, but they didn't.
Yeah, with the skill set he had, the natural physical charisma he exudes, the right presentation of him, you still need a guy like Judge Jim Jones or some sort of manager guy to kind of, you know, like your Harley Race type of guy for Vader, someone to just smooth out the edges on the promo side of things. But he exudes the physical charisma, and the match work was there. I don't know that I'm going too far out on a limb by saying he is the biggest under-realized talent in the ring in the 1990s, because where he was versus where he could have been, which is a main event level guy for either one of the two companies in 98, 99, 2000, I think that it's not speaking too far out of class here.
I don't think you are. I'd have to ponder that, but maybe some of the listeners can. You can always DM me on X if you like. Next week, I think I'm going to do a Steiners match. I just haven't decided which team I want, because I'm thinking Miracle Violence Collection. I think there's a couple of Muto.
I love what Sonya Deville and her girls are doing these days.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't realize the Steiners had a match against them.
Maybe Doom. I don't know. Maybe the Varsity Club.
Steiners and Doom's a good one.
We'll see. I'll get that out on the Shake Them Ropes Twitter. But it is time for us to go. You can follow me at CrapGame13 on X. You can follow the show at Shake Them Ropes, all one word, on X. You can follow Chris only on Instagram at DOCTOR_NOV. We are part of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. All sorts of podcasts that will be telling you all about their Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame ballots this week, next week, in the weeks to come. I also do a show on Fight Game Media where my co-host Paul will also be telling you about his Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame ballot. We do a show called The Dynamite Show, comes out on, or we go live on YouTube about 20 minutes after Dynamite on YouTube, drops in your podcatchers for free the next day for audio. We do a thorough deconstruction of AEW, and by thorough, I mean like nuts and bolts, like Jeff, you're being too nitpicky thorough. So if you like that kind of thing, you can listen to me there. Chris has a Spotify he'd like to plug, and also lessons, yeah, and gigs and other things and whatnot. So I'm giving him the floor right now.
So it sounds like if you're not looking to hear about the Wrestler Observer Hall of Fame digested six ways from Sunday for the next week and a half, it's not a bad time to go and check out some of my music. I actually have been doggedly recording the next batch of songs here. I think the next pack of songs is going to be a four-pack of songs. I'll probably still put them out one at a time, but I've got four in the hopper right now. They'll be out in the next 4 or 6 weeks. But great time to check out the stuff if you haven't checked it out right now. Out of My Mind and Take It to the Grave both have single edits up. If you want music lessons, please hit me up on Instagram. That is instagram.com/DOCTOR_NOV. Otherwise, I just want you to keep on rocking in that free world.
Do you like wrestling trivia? Then check out the 5-Star Match Game, the Pro Wrestling Quiz Show. I'm Joe Gagne, and every episode, I grill 3 contestants with 5 rounds of power-packed wrestling trivia. We have over 30 evergreen episodes in the archives covering WWE, AEW, Japan, Mexico, and much, 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 much more. Play along at home and check it out today.